Welcome to the Animal Wellness Podcast, all about improving the lives of animals with better policies and practices in government and business. Brought to you by Animal Wellness Action, where we believe helping animals helps us all. Here's your host, Joseph Grove.
Welcome, everyone. Hi, I'm Joseph Grove, and I'm glad you are with us for the show. Ryan is our producer. Ryan, I was listening to our last episode in which we made a promise to our audience that we would do more shows. Yet that was the first week of January, I think. Here it is March. We're slackers. We are slackers when it comes to updating the show. But we continue to work on getting more episodes out. Thank you for your patience. Glad you tune in when we do post one, our audience. And be apprised that we are working on a way to bring some additional support to the show. And in fact, I'll say to our listeners, if you know of anyone who would be interested in volunteering to help put these shows together, we could use some extra bandwidth. So we would appreciate learning about that. You can email me at joseph@animalwellnessaction.org. But until then, I think we've got a good show for you today. Most of our episodes go pretty deep into the weeds when it comes to legislative affairs, what senators doing what regulations are being put out there. They can be pretty technical. So every once in a while, I like to cleanse the editorial palate by talking about things that are more on the ground level, eye to eye with the animal. We had a fascinating show last year with a woman who rescues gamecocks, has a sanctuary for them. She pulls them from people who have been arrested for fighting the birds, or law enforcement gives them to her. And it was an incredible story. And I'm excited today to have three people involved on similar levels with different animals on this broadcast. So I want to introduce two of them. They'll be in part one of the show. The third guest will be in the second part of the show, and we'll get to her in a little bit. But with us right now, we have Paul Collins and Alicia Torres. So Paul is our state director for Animal Wellness Action in Wisconsin, which is also where Alicia lives and works. Paul is a lifelong animal advocate who was born and raised in Wisconsin. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Disaster and Emergency Management from Upper Iowa University, which everyone knows is better than Lower Iowa University, right? I mean, that's why they call it Upper. He's worked as a public servant in law enforcement and higher education public safety agencies for more than two decades. Paul has had a lifelong passion for animals and has been actively advocating for them for more than a decade in his home state, especially for wildlife. He is also a board member of Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf and Wildlife and worked with Wisconsin-based Alliance for Animals. He did that in 2019 to help design and erect numerous billboards about how Wisconsin pays reckless hound hunters when their dogs are killed by wolves. So you're a hound hunter, you're out there, you're trying to kill a wolf, the wolf gets the dog. Wisconsin was paying for the dog, which for those of us in the animal space just sounds obscene. Paul lives with four rescue dogs and two rescue cats. He has also worked with wildlife rehabilitators to transport injured and orphaned wildlife for many years. And I also appreciate always talking to Paul. We won't get into it here, but he is an avid aviation enthusiast. So if you follow Paul on Facebook, you'll see all of his adventures in airplanes, his models, the air shows he goes to, and I find all of that absolutely fascinating. Alicia is the operations director at Heartland Farm Sanctuary up there. Heartland provides specialized care to rescued farm animals, offers empathy-based humane education programs, and provides experiential therapy for young people in partnership with our animals to create a mutually supportive space for healing. So I'm glad to have both of you folks on the show. Paul, before we understand more about Heartland Farm Sanctuary, tell us from an Animal Wellness Action state director's perspective, what's going on in your state? What are some of the big issues you're facing right now, and what are you up to up there?
With Wisconsin, the number one priority always seems to be wolves and wildlife. That's always been the priority since I started with the organization. Not necessarily the only issue facing animals in Wisconsin, but it's always been the big one. And Of course, we're a huge agriculture state, so there's always issues around farm animals and such. And we have a very hostile legislature that makes it extremely difficult to get any animal protection laws in place. So unfortunately, we're kind of always on the defensive when it comes to our wildlife and our domestic animals. But that's kind of why I became a volunteer with Heartland Farm Sanctuary, so I could actually see the positives of working with animals and not always having to dwell on the negatives. So right now in Wisconsin, the main thing I'm working on is getting ready for a wildlife lobbying day at the Capitol on in Madison on April 18th. There'll be more information about that to Animal Wellness Action followers and people that are interested. But right now, with our legislative session kind of winding down, there isn't too much going on that front.
Well, tell me how you heard about Heartland Farm Sanctuary and what you do for them now.
I first heard about Heartland. Well, I know I first heard about Heartland probably back in 2011 or 2012. And one of the most overlooked parts of any story that you hear about animal rescues is what happens to the animals afterward. And you hear about the animals that are rescued from cockfights, neglect, abandonment, but we hear very little about how or even if they're able to live out the rest of their lives. So when I first heard about Heartland, I was quite intrigued and I decided it was something that I had to make a visit to. So when I learned about their sanctuary in Verona, Wisconsin, which was at the time much smaller facility than they have now, I found out that they were dedicated to giving abandoned, abused, and neglected farm animals a home. And this was everything from miniature horses to cows to even emus, who I work with on a weekly basis now at the sanctuary, and I just absolutely adore them. Not something you get to see every day in Wisconsin. So anyway, after visiting the sanctuary back in I think it was 2012, I started donating a small amount of money each month. They have a program called Stable Supporters, where you give a small amount each month, and it just I've been doing that for years. And of course, I always wanted to volunteer, but where they were located in Verona was extremely inconvenient for me since I work a full-time job during the week, and getting there early on the weekends just wasn't going to work out. But I made a visit to, after I became state director, I made a visit to Heartland and met with Alicia and Jen Kors, who is the director of Heartland. And they told me about they're going to be relocating to Wisconsin, which is where I lived, and it was just a little bit outside of town. So I no longer had any more excuses. I absolutely had to start volunteering. So in October of 2022, I started volunteering at the sanctuary. At the time, there was just a couple of goats, Murphy and Truffle, the emus, and some of the smaller birds. So I started out real small, but then they built a brand new, fantastic barn, brought all the animals from Verona over, and now they have they've fully integrated into the new location with giant pastures for the animals. It's just incredible. I mean, it's the highlight of my weekend getting to go there and work with these animals. And so I do this each Saturday. Each morning, I spend about 2.5, 3 hours at the sanctuary, doing everybody's favorite cleaning up poop and hanging out with the animals. But absolutely makes my weekend. It's just the highlight of every week. I've kind of become the Saturday morning goat man for Heartland because I've developed such an affinity for the goats. And for whatever reason, they've bonded with me and I have bonded with them. And now they're all the residents are a part of my heart. It doesn't mean that I prefer the goats over the other animals because I absolutely adore all of them. They're wonderful, but it's given me a unique opportunity to work with animals that the average person wouldn't normally be able to work with. I mean, animals that people that see as food or they see as a product, whatever else, I get to work with them and learn their personalities and learn that each one is an individual and each one deserves protection and each one deserves to live out their lives. And I found that I spend so much time dwelling in the negative when it comes to animal protection stuff. Because as I mentioned earlier, we're always on the defensive here in Wisconsin, always. Heartland has given me an opportunity to see the positive, to feel the love from the animals, to give the animals love, to see the people that work there feel the same way toward these animals and all of the things that Heartland provides to the community, the camps for kids, the therapy for kids, teaching a more humane way of living. It's just been fantastic. My favorite story is a little goat named Hank. He was let down by humans twice. He was found chained to a bed in a small apartment in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. He was confiscated from there, and he was taken to a farm in Dodge County, Wisconsin, where a hobby farm, apparently, where Hank and all the other residents were left abandoned after the people were evicted. They were left starved to death, basically. Hank got rescued, taken to the sanctuary, along with some of the other animals that were there, were brought to Heartland, and Hank's kind of become my little buddy, and I'm extra protective of him, even though he likes to take out my knees every week. but his story is, I kind of, every week I say to Hank that, you know, we're not going to let you down again, little buddy. And he's just one of the many stories of what Heartland and other similar farm sanctuaries have been able to do for animals that have been let down by humans time and time again.
You know, I was going to work with goats once, but I decided it was a bad idea.
That's more sheep, but.
You see, I don't know. I'm such a city person. Goats, they all sound the same to me. So, Alicia, thanks for coming on. And I have to ask you this. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best you've ever seen and 1 being the worst, how is Paul when it comes to cleaning up animal poop?
He is a 10, and we always save the goat stalls for Paul because those are some of the most challenging stalls.
And the stinkiest.
Yeah, we're like, Paul's going to do it. He is an excellent volunteer, and I loved hearing, Paul, how you came to Heartland. That's really special.
Yeah. Well, tell us how you came to be involved. Alicia, I don't know much about you. This is my first time meeting you. How did you get into working with animals, and how did that manifest to the sanctuary?
Yeah, I also started as a volunteer. I started in 2011. And at the time, I was just working in an office. I have a degree in social welfare, but I've always been passionate about animals and always followed farm sanctuaries. One day I was Googling and it came across Heartland Farm Sanctuary that had just started taking animals in 2010. So they were pretty new. And I was like, wow, there's a farm sanctuary in my town. It was really just so fortunate to have found it. So I started volunteering and just from day one, fell in love and became obsessed with the place. I volunteered as much as I could for about a year, and then was offered a part-time position to be assistant to the founder. And I helped her out for a while and then started doing tours of the sanctuary, just as much as I could, just started adding on jobs until I was able to have a full-time position, and then quit my office job. And I did not regret that decision at all. It's just been a passion, and I feel so fortunate to be a part of it every day. I also love hearing people talk about it, how special it is, because I think I just take it for granted that I get to see emus every day, you know, or that I get to, like, you know, pick up a chicken or groom a goat. Those are all the things that we get to do that are so unique, but everybody doesn't get that experience. And I wish everybody did have that opportunity.
When in your life did you first realize you had a special passion for animals? Was there a pivotal moment? How old were you?
I think I was born that way. My mom was vegetarian and just raised my brother and I to be very sensitive to all animals. I remember walking to school and picking up worms off the ground and putting them back in the grass, you know, if it had just rained and they were out. You know, I was just always looking out for little animals and always very sensitive about that stuff. I think that's why I, you know, started researching farm sanctuaries and finding out more about them. I have been vegetarian for about 30 years and went vegan almost 15 years ago. So I feel like I've always been that animal lover, but just growing and learning more, starting to just understand the systems that are in place and how we use animals. So I just feel like I've always been that way, but obviously just evolved as I've grown.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it, right? Once you get the image of this animal as a person in his or her own right, not a human, of course. I'm not making an equivalency there, although in many instances, I think the comparison would come out in favor of the animal and not the human. But once you understand that personhood, that there's a life there, that there's a there there, there's a something worth saving, an individual and unique inside these animals, you can't go back. Paul, I just want to resonate too with what you said a second ago about the work on the farm being helpful to your overall advocacy. I went to a farm sanctuary a few months ago now to do a video, and got to spend time with, you know, some of the pigs. They had some cows and some other animals. And it was so refreshing. It really reminded me of why I do what I do. And it's this way, obviously, for you, Paul, on Saturdays, and you every day, Alicia, it reminds you of why you do all the work. Most of my job, and Paul's, yours maybe the same way when it comes to this stuff, is we sit at a computer and we type emails and we do podcasts, for example, and so much of it is detached from the animal. It really is heartening to go out and be there and interact with them, because it is an interaction if you look at it and pay attention to it. So I'm going on too much about it, but I really do love this subject. So tell us about Heartland itself, Alicia. How big is it now? How many animals do you have? Give us a sense for what the sanctuary really comprises.
Sure. Well, the reason we moved to Stoughton is to be able to take in more animals. We're still in the building process. We had 15 acres in Verona. Here in Stoughton, we have close to 40 acres. We currently have close to 70 animals. We've certainly had more animals than that in the past, but with our move and just growing, we're being cautious about how many animals we take in, only because we are dedicated to providing them with really high quality care, which includes vet care, which is expensive. So we definitely want to have more animals in the future. We hope to build a pig barn that will open up a lot of spaces in our current barn. We also have to finish construction on a quarantine area that will allow us to bring in new animals. We can't do too much of that right now because animals have to be quarantined for 30 days separate from the rest of the population. So we're in a still a kind of a transitional phase, but have the capacity there for a lot more growth. The animals come from a variety of situations. Some are from cruelty and neglect cases. Some are found homeless. Actually, quite a few animals are found homeless. Chickens are often dumped if they turn out to be roosters. You know, people think they're getting hens and they turn out to be roosters, and then they can't keep them. So we have two roosters right now, Leaf and Gunner, who were dumped in a local park. And we think that that's probably why that happened, that people just assumed that that'd be a great area for them to live out the rest of their lives. And it absolutely wouldn't have been, because they would have frozen to death or been killed by predators. Homeless situations come up too with ducks, animals being found. We've had several pigs over the years who have fallen from transport trucks, little baby pigs that are found on the highway. That's actually more common than you might think. So anytime animals are found homeless, you know, we're often a resource for them if they're farm animals. Some of our animals also come from situations where they've actually had a really good life. It could be from someone who's having financial difficulties or health difficulties that makes it so that they're not able to keep their companion animals that just so happen to be goats or chickens. So that we do have animals as well that come from people that appreciate who they are, all variety of animals. I think at Heartland, they get so much positive attention that eventually a lot of the animals are able to come out of their shell, even if they have that difficult background, just because we have 100 volunteers loving on them. And, all that positive energy going their way is very helpful for healing. We actually have close to 30 staff. They're not all animal care. We do the humane education programs such as camps, so and you know tours and that sort of thing. So we have a humane education staff. We also have licensed therapists working with us, and they the experiential therapy is its own separate people program. And then with animal care, we have about 10 animal care caregivers and myself. So it's a large staff, but we're also doing a lot of people programs in addition to the animals.
And that's fascinating to me. It's certainly well known that working with animals is a great therapeutic tool. And you have a background in social work, as I would unprofessionally characterize it based on what you said. Talk about these camps, the therapy programs. How do you see these? I assume that we're talking in many cases about children, if not exclusively so. How do you see them respond to the animals, and what do they come away with in terms of a better soul?
That's a really good question. I don't have children of my own, and I guess I wouldn't say I'm a real big kid person, but I've always been an animal person. But my absolute favorite thing at the sanctuary is camp time when there's kids there, because I see the wonder and the excitement for meeting these little people that are, you know, different from the dogs and cats that they know. And I think it's just the most amazing thing when you see them get that awareness that these animals are just like the dogs and cats they know at home. They all have distinct personalities, things they like. You know, you'll have the kids making breakfast for the animals, and they're just so tickled to find out, like, this pig doesn't like green peppers, or this, you know, chicken won't eat lettuce. You know, like, they learn these things that all of these residents are individuals. So I think for the humane education programs, that's the most important thing, just giving kids that opportunity, because they're not going to make any larger connection if they don't meet these individuals. Once they meet them and understand that this is somebody with a name and a personality, then it's a lot easier for them to be compassionate to all animals. The therapy programs, we're really careful not to call them animal-assisted therapy. Instead, we do experiential therapy, and that is because we're not requiring the animals to take part in therapy sessions. There's each child that comes to work with a therapist, there are certain goals that they're trying to accomplish. And those goals could be accomplished by a walk in the woods, or doing crafts, or, you know, saying hello to an animal. We just want to make sure that there's a distinction between using the animals for people and just the reality of what it is at Heartland is these animals are just living here. They're residents living out their entire lives, and they just happen to interact with people when they feel like it. So animals always have the option to walk away. And if someone walks away from you, that means visit over. You know what I mean? It's definitely up to them how much they participate. So that teaches people things as well. You know, it teaches them boundaries and all of those important things, just watching body language and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so it sounds like that approach to the animal is very much, well, it reminds me, let me just say it this way. When I was married and we had, the cats, there would be a cat sleeping on the bed, and one of the kids would say, "Well, I want to go get the cat and bring it in here so it can lay on me." And I would always say that you're violating that cat's rights. I said it somewhat as a hyperbole, but my point is that the cat isn't there just so we can pick it up and bring it and set it on our laps whenever we feel like having a cat on our life. It's one thing if the cat wants to come and sit on your lap, terrific, but it's not a prop for you to just bring like a pillow. Is that kind of the same mentality? Is that what's going on with that, Alicia?
Absolutely. Yeah, you hit it right on the head. It's these are individuals with free will, and they should be able to do exactly what they want to do within reason. We obviously have to have fences and pens to keep them safe, you know, because we're on a highway. So there's those type of things, but we do those things because these are domesticated animals who aren't going to survive in the wild on their own. But in their spaces that we have created for them, it is absolutely their choice. They have choice over what they do.
I love that, and I'm going to play this for my now adult children and say, burn. I was on to something. Thank you. What kind of psychological challenges a child might have would warrant a therapist recommending some experiential therapy with you? Is this depression, shyness, ADHD? What are the diagnoses you're seeing?
It could be any of those. We don't often know, at least in, I should say, I don't often know, being in the animal care department, I don't often know what the specific diagnoses are that the kids are coming in with. But, you know, yes, all of those things you listed, autism, anything that, you know, if their families have felt that they would benefit from this very peaceful sanctuary setting can come here. I think that really the most important thing when you're talking about the animal part of it, as I mentioned, you know, they may never see an animal here if they don't choose to. They may be off in the woods doing something if that's more therapeutic. But the something that I have seen myself is that for kids or for anyone who may be having challenges communicating with an animal is a heck of a lot easier than communicating with a person. They don't judge us. If, as we mentioned, their choice being with us, you know, just the fact that they want to be with us and share companionship with us is very rewarding. And a lot of times I would just see kids sitting and talking to an animal. And that to me feels really good because, you know, they're sharing that moment and the kids are allowed to think what they want and say what they want without judgment. So I think it really does free people up to be able to just be themselves a lot easier in the company of animals.
Well, I agree. And I think that's beautiful. How can our listeners help Heartland? I'm sure you're on Facebook and I've been to your website. It's a beautiful, well-done website. What do you need?
Yeah, we are largely run on donations, so that's always wonderful. Supporting us with any events that you see in the community is wonderful. Taking part in the programs, you know, telling people about our summer camp and encouraging people to find out how to be just more compassionate in general, getting involved with our programs is great. Volunteering is wonderful. Our volunteer commitment is one shift per week for at least 6 months, so it is a significant you know, you have to really be committed to it. But I think as you heard Paul talking, I think that people always do get a lot out of it. So that it comes out to about 3 hours a week. So, but yes, volunteering, donations, all of those things are very much appreciated.
Animal wellness action depends on people like you to complete our work. Our recent victories to protect big cats, spare beagles from pharmaceutical tests, and convince Nike to stop killing kangaroos for shoes would not have happened without the financial support of our donors. Become one today at any amount. Visit animalwellnessaction.org/donate to join our fight against animal cruelty of all kinds. That's animalwellnessaction.org/donate.
Welcome back from the break. Thanks for staying with us. As I mentioned, we have another guest on the show. Her name is Robin Herman. Now, full disclosure, I know Robin rather well. We are cousins. We grew up mostly together. We're a couple of years apart. Robin, I almost said you were a couple of years older, but that wouldn't necessarily be politics. So I'm just going to say we're mostly contemporaries. And I owe Robin a lot. She was one of my childhood best friends. She and I played Hot Wheels together for years. And she introduced me, as I grew up in a home that was more hee-haw than hip-hop, to rock and roll music. Every time, as I've told her, I hear an Elton John song, I think of Robin. So I love her. And not only that, I'm inspired by her and consider her one of my mentors, one of my inspirations when it comes to taking care of animals. So, Robin, thank you for being on my podcast.
Sure.
Talk about Lucky Dog Retreat. For years, you had this terrific business in Indianapolis, where you live now. And how did it get started? And what was just your mindset in creating this venue for Animal Retreat?
Well, I was working in the corporate world during the week and volunteering on weekends at dog shelters. And I wanted to help more dogs. I wanted to save more dogs, but I had a house payment and car payments. So I needed to make some money. And I was in Muncie doing a dog fighting presentation to the Rotarians. We were showing them things to look for to spot dog fighting going on. And the lady that had us do that was the host of the meeting that day. And she had a doggy daycare and I had never seen one before. I didn't want to open a boarding kennel. I didn't want to open anything else to try and make money while I was saving dogs, because it wouldn't, I don't want to lock them in cages and then try and save them. I wanted to do something that dogs liked. So I saw a dog daycare for the first time in my life. And I said, oh, I can do that. And 6 months later we opened. And the goal was to open a facility to help dogs. Like people don't, you know, Lassie's not at the pound waiting to be adopted and then goes home and sits by the fireplace all day and waits for the owner to come home. The dogs that people rescue from the pound sometimes have pent up energy and like to eat the couch while the owners are at work. And if they can bring them to daycare, they don't have to worry about leaving them at home, and we can help get their energy out. If they're, you know, a young family with two kids at home, got to get them from school, got to get dinner made. You know, this is a way that we can help them have dogs and take care of them during the day and then board them over the weekends or over the vacations. And the dogs don't stress themselves out so much because they're coming to a fun place to board. So they don't mind boarding. So it was a way that I could still enjoy dogs and make a little bit of money while we would save dogs. And we would just go get a couple from the pound, integrate them into the population of dogs, put them on Pet Finder, and adopt them. So that's how the whole thing started.
Over time, obviously, it grew. You started off in a section of, I guess what I would call, without pejorative, a strip mall in Indianapolis. Yep. But things really took off for you, didn't they?
It went really, really well. If, you know, dog people are great people, and I loved our clients, and we grew and grew and grew. In 2012 is when we went for our 501c3, and we created Lucky Dog Retreat Rescue, which was the other arm of the business. And all told, we were saving nearly 100 animals a year, 100 dogs a year.
Right. By finding them in shelters, bringing them into Lucky Dog, putting them on Pet Finder. And yep. How many animals, how many dogs would you say were pulled by you and your team from the pounds and now have happy lives?
No, there was almost 1,400 dogs.
All right. 1,400 dogs. You know, we talked a little bit before the show about an anecdote I'll ask you to repeat relative to your upcoming Parvo clinic. But it reminds me that maybe one of the biggest challenges you had was dealing not with the dogs, but with the people who let them go into shelter and maybe who weren't always ready for the responsibility of taking care of a rescued dog. Which was more burdensome, the dogs or the people?
A lot of time. I mean, the longest we always said, we'll take the dog back. The oldest dog that we ever had to take back from an owner was 12 years old. We took him back after they'd been adopted for 6 years. We didn't even remember the dog. And 6 years later, all of a sudden they're moving and can't take the dog. And so they bring it back to us. That was the heartbreaking part of it.
Right. And I glommed onto, as you were speaking, what you said about how rescue dogs, maybe any dog, even if it's coming to a home after adolescence, let's say, and is not a rescue dog, they do take time to acclimate, don't they? Just as you and I would, if we were going into a new home. They're not just going to immediately find that peace of mind.
Absolutely. We kind of stopped adopting dogs right before Thanksgiving and right before Christmas, because a lot of times when we would adopt out a dog, this happened several times that we would adopt out a dog right before Thanksgiving. And I think people are thinking, you know, I'm on break, I'm on winter break, it's time I can adopt a dog. And then they would have the whole family over for Thanksgiving, the dog flipped out, and then they bring them back. So, you know, they don't give them, they just assume that the dog knows that they're in a safe place and this is all better. And the dog doesn't understand that. The dog's just in another environment, and it takes them a little while, up to 3 months, to really feel safe. And a lot of times dogs, when they don't feel safe, they don't behave properly.
Right. I'm taking care of my son's dog while he's mobile for a few months. And it's taken this dog, whose name is Vegas, a while to acclimate to my home, even though Dylan has been in and out. That's my son. And it's really a process, isn't it? They yes. do have to be comforted. They have to find their way around, get used to the new sights and smells. I think in the old house in which I live, there are squirrels. I'm hoping they're squirrels that like get into the crawl space, and sometimes I can hear them, and it drives Vegas crazy. She, you know, she's not used to it. And I'm hoping one day she'll settle down to that, because if this weren't my son's dog, and if I weren't a person of a heart who would be disinclined to rehome a dog, I got to tell you, I don't know that I would have been prepared to endure the challenges presented by this temporary rehoming.
Well, and a lot of times people misunderstand dogs. Most of the time, dogs react out of fear, but they're not fearful like we are. They're not going to, well, some of them are, they're going to go hide in a corner. But a lot of times, you know, dogs are set to protect themselves. And if they hear something that's scary, they're going to go get it before it gets them, because they're animals and they still have little lizard brains that they operate out of. And a lot of times their immediate response is misconstrued as aggression when it's just fear. And
interesting.
And a dog, by the way, my fine cousin, will not acclimate to noise. You have to counter condition that behavior. So maybe every time the squirrels scratch, you take a handful of kibble and throw it into the carpet and make the dog go find it and distract them from the scratching. And then sooner than later, the dog is going to say, oh, scratching food. And scratching is going to become a good thing to happen instead of a scary thing to happen. Just throwing that out there.
No, that's good, because I was thinking of stocking up on NyQuil. And
for you or the dog?
Maybe both of us, Robin. I've been thinking the dog, but maybe me.
No NyQuil for the dog. Dogs can take melatonin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right. No. Interesting.
Might try a white noise machine. Mm-hmm. So the dog can't hear the scratching.
Talk about COVID, Robin, because I know I heard all kinds of stories about, yay, the shelters are empty. This is a great thing for dogs. It turned out to not be the case, though.
That is very true. Two things happened during COVID. One, people decided that they had nothing better to do at home, so they might as well get a dog, which is a great idea, because now they're home, they can work with the dog. Then while that was going on, there were people that thought, well, since the shelters are empty and people want dogs, we'll just invite little Buffy over, and Buffy and Freddie can make more puppies, and we'll sell them, and we'll call them Doodles or something. We'll get them curly and call them Doodles, and we'll sell them for whatever, and we'll make some money. So we had two things going on. The backyard breeders, this gave a vehicle for them to peddle their puppies. While, you know, the normal amount of dogs are still being born. And then when people had to go back to work, so the dog finally acclimated to home. They acclimated to the computer. They acclimated to going potty several times a day. They acclimated to a lot of things. And then all of a sudden we go back to work and the dog is left alone all day and is now terrified because they're alone and they're set to protect this huge house. And they haven't been acclimated to being in a crate. So while they're terrified in the house, again, a misunderstanding that people think the dog is trying to get back at them. The dog just destroys the house because it's in a panic, running around, trying to look out windows and trying to figure out what it's doing, and has a lot of energy that it doesn't know what to do with except to eat the couch. So we march the dog back to the pound. So now the pounds have been full for at least a year, just packed from dogs being returned, puppies being returned, and just the whole supply chain got way out of whack.
You know, I figured it was the case that people brought dogs back whom they regretted adopting. It did not occur to me that part of the problem is the backyard breeding you talked about. So, Robin, I would imagine while you're running the retreat, you had difficulty with staffing. You probably struggled, I would guess, as many employers did, to find and keep people during and in the aftermath of the epidemic.
Absolutely. And when you're talking about jobs in animal care, I cannot hire. I worked for McDonald's for 28 years. I could teach anybody how to make French fries. I could teach anybody how to make a hamburger. That would go pretty quickly. You cannot teach people how to manage several dogs. They're all different. There's no one answer that's going to work for every dog. The kids need to work there. They need to know the dogs. They need to know what works for each dog. So a lot of turnover in young workers is just a recipe for disaster in the shelters, in boarding facilities, everywhere, because there's no SOP on how to manage a particular dog. They're all different. They all perceive things differently, and it's just getting to know them. So the labor force was fraught with turnover, and no matter how of a happy place we tried to make it, you know, there's still things going on, and the parents are home. The kids don't want to drive. So the parents have to stop what they're doing and take the kid to work. And it just, so I sold the profit side of the business, the employment side of the business, and we kept the rescue.
Gotcha. I did want to ask before we move away from COVID completely and the impact on shelters of the post-COVID animal care world. I believe it's the case that many shelters who had been or which had been, excuse me, no kill had to resume euthanizing animals.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I mean, they were in the halls. There's, you know, and people blame the shelters. Our shelter takes in about 34 dogs a day.
And that's just the Indianapolis metropolitan area.
Correct. And there's, where are you going to put them? They got to go someplace. And it's not fair to put them in a little box. They're freaked out. The smell of panic. And, you know, then they lose their little minds in those little cages. And it's not fair to them.
Right. Right. No, for sure. So thank you. So you recently sold the for-profit side, which means in essence, you're retired. Fair to say?
I am retired.
Yeah, but I think retirement life for you will not look like what one normally envisions retirement life to be. If I know you, you're going to be as busy as you ever were.
Yes.
Yes. With dogs. All right. With just dogs.
More with my dogs than everyone else's dogs.
Right. Yeah, I will let our listeners know that Robin is very involved with duck diving. And one of the things I find fascinating about her involvement with this sport is a mission she can say more about, and that is to show some of her competitors that you don't need to invest thousands in a specialty breed to do it. Robin uses rescue dogs And by golly, they do pretty well. Robin, talk about that.
Well, I've had five rescue dogs that have made a world champion podium somewhere, be it in disc, agility, or dock diving. I just go find the dogs that would eat the couch, that have a little bit of energy, a little bit of drive, a little bit of work ethic. Try and find the right one, pull them out, and then introduce them to different sports and see which ones they like. I used to just do Frisbee. Then I ended up kind of in agility with Skeeter because she enjoyed that. And then Rigby, I only took her to dock diving because I like the sport, because it's in water and it's a nice summer sport. You sit by a lake, your dog jumps off the dock, and it's a lot of fun. And her biggest jump right now is 31 feet. So she was in nationals last year. She came in 10th. So she's an awesome little dock diver dog. But, you know, so many times people will say, well, I want to do agility, so I'll go spend a lot of money on a dog that ought to do well in agility. And when the dog doesn't do well, then they're frustrated. Instead of introducing them maybe to a different sport, you know, you gotta go with the dog. Like if you want your kid to play football and they love baseball, you gotta become a baseball fan. That's right. Just kind of how it goes with dogs too. You can't just get them and make them do a sport. They won't do right. it well, and they've got to have fun.
We talked on the phone a couple of weeks ago about a dog that came into your care, and I think it's safe to use the dog's name. Of course, we won't mention the owner's name, but the dog's name is Myla. And Myla had a pretty tough road, but it sounds like through your work and a project you're planning in April, Myla may indirectly save hundreds of dogs. Tell us about Myla and tell us about the aftermath of her story coming up in a few weeks.
One part of it gets a little bit confusing, but our Pound, our Indianapolis Animal Care Services, they post rescue dogs. And I meant to say this earlier, the dogs that we have pulled, the 1400 dogs that we have pulled, we don't go and pull them off the adoption floor and then turn around and adopt them. We pull dogs off the rescue list. So we pull dogs that have either been hit by cars or are sick or need some sort of medical care. Most of the time they've either been hit by a car and have a broken pelvis, broken legs, or they are sick with parvo. Because what happened with Myla is that when their dog all of a sudden starts to get sick and they take him to the vet, and the vet will say, your dog's got parvo, it's going to be at least $2,000. Do you have $2,000? And the person says no, and then the vet says, well, I can't help you. And then we get mad at the vets, but you know, they're a business too. They're paying nurses and vet techs and receptionists and all sorts of medical equipment. So they've got to make money too. And parvo is very expensive. So how Myla came about is that our Pound post dogs on the rescue site, on their rescue site on Facebook. So they'll say, this dog has been hit by a car. They won't post adoptable dogs. To that, you go to the Pound or go to Pet Finder. But the rescue dogs, they post. And well-doers across the city will offer money. So I'll give $20 to the rescue if you pull this dog. So once a rescue pulls the dog, then the Pound says, okay, LDR Rescue pulled this dog, so pay them. And here's the link. So a tenacious dog owner who loves their dog and wants their dog back can follow that page and see where their dog goes. And that's what Myla's owner did. So she knew the rescue came to us. So she started making phone calls, trying to get her dog back. And we've had that happen occasionally. And for the most part, we're like, sorry, you can't. We have to change their names on Pet Finder so that the owners won't find them. And usually when we take them, we're not real public about it, because when the owners try and come back, and that's not okay. You can't go let your dog get hit by a car, let somebody like me pay to fix it, and then go and readopt it for $150. That's I spent $3,000 on this dog and you let it get hit by a car, and chances are it's going to get hit by a car again. And in this case, we kept getting parvo dogs. So all of a sudden my phone will ding and I'll look, and there's a quick, cute picture of this little suffering puppy that's sick and needs help. And my choice is to either help it or not. And if I don't, if I'm not going to help it, it's really kind of out of options at that point. And the vets can't just fix them all. And then the vets have no way to adopt them once they do that. Anyway, so Mila's mom started calling Lucky Dog Retreat the profit side of the business, thinking it was them. Started emailing, wanted her dog back, wanted her dog back. And I just ignore it for the most part because, once you get into some sort of conversation, if they don't understand already, it's going to be difficult for them to understand. So anyway, Mila's owner kept emailing me. And finally, she was accusing us of not getting back to her, nobody would help her, blah, blah, blah. And finally, I just wrote her back and I was like, look, the reason that we haven't called you back is that we're cutting our yard and going grocery shopping and working, and we can't use our employer's phone, and we're just regular people trying to save your dog. So that's why nobody's gotten back to you. And you could be a little bit more grateful that your dog was taken and saved. And, she was almost, well, $4,800 and a long night for me on the phone with the vet all night, discussing whether we should, for her best interest, euthanize her. She was so miserable.
With Parvo.
With Parvo, it just tears up their intestines and she can't eat, she can't hold any food down, and her intestines are just shedding everything, blood, they're just deteriorating. And it's a horrible thing to watch. So after that, she got very grateful, very thankful when she realized, there's no help for dogs, there's no help for animals. You can't just say, I need help. You have to vaccinate them. And the reason that we don't usually give back dogs with parvo is because a $16 vaccination could have stopped this whole thing. And if you didn't vaccinate them, then you're not going to give them rabies shots. You're not going to take care of them. You're not going to give them heartworm treatment every month. You're not going to give them flea treatment every month. And you're not going to take good care of them because you didn't take good care of them then. Well, Milo's mom helped me change my mindset on that. And she sent me pictures of Mila as a puppy, those Facebook pictures where she's all cute in the back seat. And I could tell this woman really, truly loved this dog. And the more we talked, she was trying to do all the right things. Her husband had just gotten a job that offers pet insurance. They'd signed up for pet insurance. They had an appointment at the vet. But all of the things that we talked about back when we talked about you and I talked about COVID, that's killing the vets right now because the vets are just packed. Because even though the pounds are full, it's not like everybody returned their dogs. Only like, I don't know, maybe a third of the people returned their dogs. There's still a bunch of dogs out there and the vets are packed. So her vaccination appointment wasn't for 2 more months. It was October, or it was the next month, and it was too late. So dogs are born with no immunity to parvo, and parvo is everywhere. If there has been a dog there, there's the potential for parvo there. They have no immunity. She didn't understand that. She didn't understand that vaccination. If you look at what new dog owners get, they get a pamphlet of all the stuff that you should do for your dog, and there's like 400 things, and they all cost money. And the one little line in there, the one little line in there that's even sometimes not even there is parvo vaccination. And that's the one thing. If you've got a dog and you've got $20 and you want to do the best thing for that dog, get it a parvo vaccination and feed it.
Tough case, happy ending, right? So Mila is back with her family and doing well. And you had an idea. Why not make it easier for people who may not have resources or time or savvy to take care of the parvo vaccination on their own? You're going to help many of these people get it. And you've named the project Indy's Parvo Project. Tell us what that is and when it is.
if we found all the vaccinations, so donated Petco Love, donated the PHPP vaccinations, Banfield donated the rabies vaccinations, our rescue bought the syringes and all the other things that we're going to need to do that. And basically, April 13th at 1505 Sherman Drive, Indianapolis, Indiana, at Fido's parking lot. Fido is Friends of Indianapolis Dogs Outside. They help build fencing and things for inner city dogs. We will vaccinate your dog for parvo free. And if we
and it's drive through too, right? I mean,
pretty much drive through. Here's your dog. Give a shot. Here's your vaccination card. See ya.
That's
and
amazing.
It was going to be just parvo, but we've managed to get some other things going as people have stepped in. But the main thing is you won't leave there without a parvo vaccination.
Right. How many dogs do you hope to vaccinate that day?
My goal is my hope is 500. Prevailing wisdom is 250.
All right. So between 250 and 500.
Yep.
Okay. All right. And then if this is a success, do you plan others in the future or is this one and done?
We're doing it again May 11th because two vaccinations is important. If you've never been vaccinated and you get one vaccination, it's effective, but it'll be twice as effective if you get one more vaccination, one more booster for that vaccination. So we're doing it again May 11th. So we'll expect new dogs and we expect a lot of return dogs. And then we're going to see where it goes. We'll keep the LDRrescue.org is our website and we'll keep lists of free vaccination clinics. Well, what we'd like to do if we can get it down a little bit smaller is do it like on our church parking lot and, you know, across the city in different places so we can get to more dogs.
Right. So the URL is LDRrescue.org.
Yes.
All right. And we'll put that in, as they say, the show notes. And if they wanted to find you on Facebook, what do they search in Facebook to find you?
LDR Rescue.
Okay. All right. Okay. Very good. All right. Robin, it sounds like an amazing project and I love leveraging the hard case of Mila to do the much greater good that will occur on April 13th. So I think that's an extraordinary story and it fits in nicely with one of my core beliefs that nobody can do everything. But everybody can do something. In the first part of the show, we talked to a man who donates part of a Saturday every week to take care of animals at a farm sanctuary. You are setting up something a little bit more grandiose and complicated, but ultimately, you know, exponentially more effective, and that is this vaccine clinic. We don't have to do everything to help animals. We can do a little bit every now and then to help animals, because let's face it, most of the world does nothing. Most of the world does nothing to help people or animals. So even by making this tiny effort or not so tiny effort, we help the cause. We make a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs might have phrased it. So Robin, I do appreciate it. Anything I've not asked that you want to address?
You know, the parvo vaccination is important, but the education is even more important. It's, you know, somehow we have to let everyone know that they have to have a parvo vaccine. It's, you know, when we have babies, you know, now not to put them on their stomach when they're little, but we didn't know that then. And if we don't tell people, then they're not going to know and it's not their fault. And it's easy for us as animal welfare people that know everything about dogs to assume that everybody knows everything about dogs, but they don't. They don't understand that, you know, nobody hears about a dog down the street that got rabies. So a rabies vaccination, yeah, whatever, I'll chance it. You shouldn't, but, you know, I get that. But you can't fix what you don't understand. And we've just got to educate that if you can't do anything, do one thing, a parvo vaccine.
Thank you for listening to the Animal Wellness Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode and follow Animal Wellness Action on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. To stay current with all of our news and information and to take action to help animals, sign up at animalwellnessaction.org. Until next time, remember that helping animals helps us all.